Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Game Dev Unchained, the number one game development podcast about game development and the lifestyle thereof. I am your host, Brandon Pham, and with me this week, a special guest, Derek Fields. How are you doing, Derek?
I am doing well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I hear you loud and clear. I see you. That is a good start so far. This is a part of the podcast where I actually ask you yourself about yourself, where you've been, where you at, where you're heading. Just a little introduction to our listeners and audience out there.
Certainly. Should I begin with any one of those questions? I'm happy to dive in.
Yeah, just talk about anything. Where you're at right now, your a little history about your game development career.
Certainly. So based in Chicago, Illinois, I've been here. It's going on something of 10 years now, originally from Ohio, and bounced around a couple of states there. But, what got me into the games industry, my story is I graduated with a background in 3D modeling and animation, could not find a job for the life of me within the space, and decided I'm just going to start making games. And so that it began the development of the studio and the game that we're here releasing soon.
Okay. And for those out there that haven't read the title, what game is that?
That is Onsen Master. And then the studio is Waking Oni Games.
Sweet. I came across, through email and just looking at everything. I think there's always at least on the Western side, a fascination with Japanese culture in general, right? With anime, especially. Onsen, I'm guessing you've had plenty experiences with it over there.
I did, yeah.
Were you in Japan for a while?
So funny background story. I used to work for a cosplay wig company and would bounce around domestically to different anime conventions, selling anime wigs. And so that had also landed me in Japan a couple of times, for both work and entertainment. So I've had the pleasure of getting there a number of times, and each of those was an opportunity to visit some onsen. One special trip was a visit to Kinosaki Onsen, which is just a hot spring town essentially, and there's an onsen across the street from another one, and you can stay at a ryokan, a certain type of hotel experience, and be able to hop in and out of them, at your leisure, which was pretty incredible.
Hmm. Your pronunciation sounds like you speak Japanese. Yeah.
that's pretty astute. So hi, choto nihongo binkyou shimashita. I studied a little bit of Japanese. Demo binkyou shite imasu. I'm still studying. It's not quite there yet. There's a part where some of my vocabulary will go well for pronunciation, and then I just hit a wall on some of the vocabulary. Tango, takusan tango wasuremashita. I forgot a lot of vocabulary, so that's where I'll hit.
That's pretty solid, man. My wife's Japanese, I personally am Vietnamese, our kids are half obviously, but way better than anything I can say or do. I'm around it, so I can tell, like, at least the pronunciation is correct, because even with me, how I say it, it's like super American onsen, right? That's awesome, dude. Like, have you always had a fascination with Japanese culture, like, growing up?
Yeah, I did. And, you know, along with games, my relationship to Japanese culture is hand in hand with being a Black American. And so, with Waking Oni, and kind of weirdly a meeting that I was just having this morning, coincidence, but, growing up as a Black individual and, you know, being born in the 80s, raised in the 90s, Toonami is an experience for a lot of kids. And specifically being a Black individual in this country, that experience with anime is a little bit different, where, you know, I was watching shows like Dragon Ball Z and then relating to certain characters and then finding that this sort of individualized experience was shared with other Black individuals, you know, who are similar in age. And so now I'm growing up and having conversations with folks who, say, for example, also coded certain characters within anime series like Piccolo from Dragon Ball as being a Black person because they represented certain, you know, qualities or characteristics within our culture. And so when it comes to creating games and when it comes to building a studio like Waking Oni, it's specifically to carry that conversation even further and not just build games that yes, have an inspiration from Japan, but also specifically talk about this sort of cultural exchange between Black and Japanese culture, because among some of those shows that I grew up with, There's Blackness. There's Blackness throughout it. We talk about Cowboy Bebop and its musicality. We talk about musicality within, you know, very obviously Samurai Champloo or Afro Samurai, mm-hmm. And how you know, Blackness and Black culture finds itself within these media, and how can we how can I then create media that is doing the inverse, you know, kind of sharing this cultural exchange back, and so by that it's to create games that prioritize Black individuals within anime inspired media. And so that's what leads me to create the games that we're working on now.
Yeah, it's definitely something, well, obviously growing up around Asian culture, like I noticed Black culture were in tune as well with Japanese, but also I'm a huge Bruce Lee fan, and a lot of Black culture are in love with Bruce Lee as well. And it just seems like, what is the attraction you feel, like the mutual respect here that seems to kind of, like, there's like a natural bridge between these two groups.
Right. And so obviously I can't speak for, you know, an entire race. I can only speak from my own personal experiences. But, you know, some of these experiences are, of course, shared. And to your point about Bruce Lee, there is this really excellent documentary called Iron Fist and Kung Fu Kicks. And it talks about the impact of Kung Fu films, of martial arts films in the Bronx specifically. And when, you know, this sort of boom of those films came about, a lot of the people who were interviewed during that documentary, you know, this created inspirations for Wu-Tang Clan. This created inspirations for Blaxploitation, you know, fighting films and things like that, where oftentimes you have a story about a hero who is going against oppression. And during the civil rights movement, oppression is the top of the list for Black individuals, and remains to be, you know, top of the list for some of us, all of us within this country today. And so I would think, at least in my experience, you know, being an individual and growing up with shonen shows and watching shows like Dragon Ball Z in the now today, you know, sharing shows with my stepson, like My Hero Academia, Naruto, and all these other things, you still have this story about an individual who has either equity or resources or power stacked against them. And then they still manage to find ways to overcome that. I think that resonates with a lot of people, but I think it especially resonates with the Black experience and why shonen shows remain so impactful for the Black community. The reason I mentioned this documentary is because I kind of look at anime as like the contemporary conversation that was being had for the impact that Kung Fu films had, you know, back when they first showed up.
Yeah, I definitely can resonate with that. My favorite type of anime have always been the kind of underdog, through each episode gaining abilities.
Yeah.
Everyone didn't really believe in them, and then ending up as a hero. I mean, that's the trope for most anime. But even Western movies, like, people, you know, I'm a sucker for, like, romantic comedies. Titanic, right? You know?
Yes.
You know, it's the same kind of hero story. You didn't really think much of this guy, and then he kind of ends up being like a, you know, the main character of the story. It's it's a very familiar thing that I think most people like, but for me especially, because of anime, a lot of Bruce Lee films, of all the stories and all the great entertainment that is out there, I'm always find myself attracted to that type of story in particular. So let's talk about onsen, man. What was your was it a culture shock going over there? Because onsen, like, public nudity is not like a very comfortable thing. Like, the first time I did it, I only did it once. I was with my father-in-law, and it's the first time I ever seen, you know, anyone really naked next to me, except for the locker room over here in the States. But there we are, we're just like, people were going there super casual because it's like a family event, almost like best friends would go in together.
Yeah.
And no one's shy about it. If anything, I was the shyest one, but it's a very regular thing over there. So what was your experience like going to Japan, but also the onsen experience?
Yeah. You know, I, pun not intended, but I dove right in, you know, with feeling comfortable in an environment like onsen. It was my first time, you know, similar to what you had mentioned, outside of a locker room experience, first time just being, you know, publicly exposed to other people who are sharing that space with you. And so, you know, I respectfully kind of observed what the pattern, the movement, the etiquette was within the environment, and kind of did my best to just mimic that, so as to not, you know, so weirdly be already a tourist, but really like highlight or spotlight that. But I went with a close friend of mine and coworker at the time. He also is the co-designer of Onsen Master, and that was it. I think it was more awkward for him than it was for me, where I was loving the space, the environment, and pleasantly boiling. As far as the rest of Japan, it was also, I don't know, it was kind of a very liberating experience. It was, in a way, it felt like I could breathe a lot more with when in the country. There's kind of an overwhelming sense of peace that that I had while getting an opportunity to go to places like Miyajima or Mount Fushimi-Inari and doing those types of things. You know, there's a sense of peace when getting to travel, you know, outside of where you live, I would imagine, for any person. You know, some of the places that we trekked to, I think, you know, felt really special for me, especially being able to carry this relationship, you know, that I had kind of grown with, in regards to Japan, and then, you know, kind of, cement that in reality.
Hmm. Well, you seem like a pretty tall guy. I can't tell for the webcam. Obviously you stuck out in every way, and being over there, I stuck out because, you know, Japan, there's not a lot of weight rooms, right? So, like, it's a lot of skinny Asians, if anything. And so, like, anything outside of that seems to be sticking out, right? So,
yeah.
But, like, everyone's super accommodating. And I think you described it best, super liberating, especially in the onsen. There is something weird about clothing. You know, I think we all like clothes. We all like to decorate ourselves and whatever and express ourselves in different ways. But it was like very liberating to just like, here I am.
Right.
as I am. And it was kind of cool
together.
Interact, and nobody was laughing or snickering or anything. It was very normal. And it was weird. If you're weird, then you're not normal. It was kind of feeling. And it was an all day event. Like, I thought it was like an hour. But we were there with my family for like 8 hours. We ate. We took a break. We had a lunch break. Had soba and everything. It was I was melting on the floor by the end of it.
Equally
experience. But what other things like stuck out about Japanese culture? Because you know, I always see them as like a meter for us, 10 years ahead of where we would be. Right. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that's happening over there that we heard before that's happening now. Right. First cell phones over there. When I was hearing that, oh, they don't have landlines. You know, everyone just have their own cell phones when we were in the 90s. Like, oh, that's crazy. No one has a landline. But now it's like happening in the States. No one really has, you know, a home phone or anything. Were you able to observe stuff like that to kind of help with your idea of that culture and, you know, as you're kind of developing this game too?
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
You mean, so as far as like maybe tech or just contemporary lifestyle that that potentially stood out to me or anything within Japan, you know, the day-to-day that was like maybe an indication of things, tech or things to come in the States? Was I understanding that question correctly?
Yeah. Just anything that stuck out to you is like, oh, this could be either a warning sign of things to come in the States, because it seems like you kind of share time here and there you know, dedicating you know, whole game towards that culture. Like, what did you spotlight here that's going on, especially post-pandemic too, right?
Yeah. You know, I think during my trip there, probably one of the most salient things that stuck with me was the juxtaposition of very for Japan, very timeless things, things like temple or like torii gates or shrines and all of these things you would find right next to a new building that's being thrown up. Or maybe there is a temple like in Kyoto, for example. There's that temple that's, I believe, fairly close to the Kyoto station, that's kind of just right in the middle of all these other buildings and stonework that's going on around it. And the efforts that are made to make sure that those things are kept around, I think are really important. Coming from Chicago, you know, Chicago experiences a lot of gentrification and pushing out of its neighborhoods, which displaces a lot of the Black and Brown community in some of those neighborhoods, you know, surrounding the city as change comes around. And so it was observing that and observing the change and the shift of very traditional or Chicago-like buildings now being traded for, you know, these kind of like Lego block condominiums or condo buildings that that you now see in a lot of areas that even in the 5 or 6 years that we've been in the neighborhood that we're in, you did not see those before. Mm. So I thought about that a lot. I thought about how aesthetic can be juxtaposed in certain ways in Japan, how you'll be taking a Shinkansen and you'll go from, you know, something like a city to somewhere else that is much more rural, and watching these things happen so quickly on a Shinkansen. This doesn't inform me if Japan is, you know, at all facing the same sorts of, gentrifications or battle with modernity and changes within its environment. I don't know that information, but at least to me, with the temples that were there, the shrines that you would see in places like Kyoto and Tokyo, it conveyed a sense of care, or at least a deliberate placement of certain agricultural changes within the city, while choosing to maintain important monuments like shrines and things like that. I would love for that same level of of preservation to be carried in certain cities. You know, like Chicago, you know, we have like old theaters and things like that. Not all of those old theaters are going to have the same level of like, no, we need to keep this, or no, let's like at least try to preserve some version of its facade while, you know, modernizing it in some kind of way. So yeah, you know, that was the main one that stuck out to me and I kind of brought back, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the preservation of history and holding on tradition is definitely something. Like even there, they're struggling, but at least they're making an effort to kind of hold on to those things of the older culture, because mm-hmm. the younger generation over there, from what I'm hearing, are starting to not, they're separating from that mindset, mm-hmm. right? It's not being passed on as much, but because I think overall the country is so clean, right? Mm-hmm. That's the one thing I noticed just stepping out of the airport. It's like everything is so clean. There's like 10 recycle bins and one is designated to a very specific thing everywhere, right? And they're all about, you know, presence and cleanliness. Yeah.
Coming from Chicago trains, you know, because we can,
right.
I can take the CTA straight into the airport. And so it can have a commute that is wildly different. You know, the CTA here will occasionally smell like pee. And it's like
a hint of urine.
You know, so to do that and then arrive and take, you know, the Yamanote line or you know, something like that was pretty great. And to your point, you know, with trash and making sure that cleanliness is maintained, something that stuck out to me was, you know, near the vending machines are probably the only times that you would see a trash can. It's usually attached to the vending machine, but there wasn't any other public trash anywhere else because it was just implied like, hey, take that with you.
Yeah. It's really cool. I mean, those little differences and the attention to detail, kind of like what you were saying, even if the old culture is trying to hold on to it, just anybody that is at least holding on to is good, because that carries on. Because if you can take a public transportation, which their system is freaking awesome, you can go anywhere and basically be able to take your whole family and not worry about smelling urine all day. Because I worked in LA, I worked in San Francisco, I took public transportation to work for commute all the time, and it is an experience every time is the best way I can put it. Right. And so to go to Japan and I think of maybe a few other countries are like this too, where their public transportation is, they see it as a foundation of how their society functions, you know, and actually upholds that for cleanliness and safety or whatever. It just, I don't know. It does elevate your day, you know, elevate the person, the individual, and therefore hopefully the society functions a little better. Just little stuff like that happens every day, I think does amount to something better, right? At least as a tourist, that was nice. It's like, oh, it's an actual vacation. Cool. I would love to kind of dive into the actual game now, Onsen Master, right?
Let's do it.
So what's the best way to describe it, right? I mean, you could have used any other setting for this type of management type of game, right? But Onsen in particular, what stuck out to you about the Onsen out of all the other choices?
Yeah. So Onsen Master is quickly described as a hot spring strategy game about healing. And, you know, the reason that an Onsen was selected, you know, for the story both comes from a deep love and admiration for the Ghibli film Spirited Away, but also the properties or idea of healing and restorement that is associated with being in an onsen. And so, you're right. As far as like a setting goes, it could have been a restaurant. It could have been Greek baths. It could have been all of these things. But, you know, that intersection of Spirited Away and Hot Spring is probably where it becomes most obvious. Mm-hmm.
So like when you first kind of, this is my favorite question, when as you're planning it and you were kind of getting your budget together or whatever, like, how long did you originally plan that the game would ship to the reality of when it did ship?
Yeah, this is, you know, games, any game being created is a miracle. Yeah. That was said to me by another friend and colleague. And that remains absolutely true. You know, Own Semester had a moderate, or I should say a modest success on Kickstarter. We raised a really small budget, which allowed us to polish off our prototype and acquire our publisher, Whitethorn Games. And so working with them has allowed us to, you know, bring on a contract team and help, you know, push this game across the finish line. Even with all that considered, we were all working part-time and, you know, our maintaining of the lives outside of creating games. Mm-hmm. And so with that considered and with, you know, the changes that happened within our life, I now have a 7-month-old and I and a, yeah, and a 14-year-old stepson. Mm-hmm. You might have heard the 7-month-old's contributions a moment ago. Mm-hmm. But that it kept the game in development for like, it was like 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. And if Own Semester was able to receive the funding that, you know, that we are now capable of being able to pitch for and leverage resources to, a game like that should only take like 2 years to make 2.5 years, ideally, you know.
Well, with COVID too, right? I mean, I bet that.
Yeah, that too. Wow. And that's a whole time warp. I completely forgot about, you know, the gap of that impact. And that had a huge impact on both, you know, our team and the publisher too. Everybody got struck by that one.
Yeah. I mean, like with indie developers, I mean, when I talk to you guys, you know, you guys are kind of used to working remote, so the impact isn't as crazy as like these bigger developers that are used to going to the office and not liking the office. And I honestly say like indie developers are actually more disciplined because they've been trained to kind of mm-hmm. operate on this type of schedule. And if anything, I'm still rooting and putting my bets on you guys kind of coming out of it okay, yeah, because of that very same reason. I don't know if you are talking to your colleagues about the kind of like a little fallout that's happening right now, but like bigger companies are really struggling just trying uh-huh. to figure this out still. You know, if anything, they're trying to get everyone back in, but yeah, you know, it's it sounds like most of what you're going through is like, you know, life events, right? And right. The development of a game is hard itself, right? It's, I mean, you're just figuring out everything, especially if you're a small team. But the unpredictable nature of life does hit us in funny ways, and very few. You know, it's an accomplishment, like you said, it's a miracle just to finish making the game. I'm sure there were high and low points during this whole development, mm-hmm. right? Some pauses and unpausing. What was your best advice to yourself to kind of keep things going? Is it daily habits or just measures you put in place in case emergencies
yeah.
like that? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, best characterized in two different ways. One component was, you know, really, really, really wanting, and I still want this, you know, there to be more games that just represent the diverse audience mm-hmm. that play them, you know, playing out. And that oftentimes kind of, and I can kind of maybe exemplify it by a small, you know, not story, but sort of characterize it in a way, but that has always brought that motivation comes together every single time I see another game release or, you know, a myriad of games being shared, through a large event. And then just still, you know, not only wanting to see myself, but just to see a broader range of protagonists and, hair textures and characters to be able to select from. When I don't see those things represented, I would say my motivator then just becomes vengeance. I'm like, mm-hmm. If this isn't going to be done, then I need to do it. And so, oftentimes I will tell people my main fuel is revenge. And rather that's against people who don't know that I'm vengeful for creating games that that better represent our community or not, then, you know, I'm still out here kind of doing it anyway. So that's really like, honestly, that's what keeps me going.
Yes.
And it fuels me to the next idea where I'm like, damn, you know, we still don't have a game that looks like this. So let's put it together. Yeah.
It's so true. I was talking to my friend Ray, and he was just on this last episode, actually, and he was complaining about how whenever he makes his own avatar, there's very little options for black people. And yeah. He was complaining there's only one hairstyle all the time.
Always
like one hairstyle. I was like, I swear that's a meme.
Fro cornrows.
As a joke. I was like, what else is there, Ray? He was like, shut up, man. So it's true. I mean, it's, you know, I get the benefit because there's the whole Japanese culture of games of Asian characters, sure. But yeah, like in Western games, it's just not, right? There's never an Asian lead character. You mean the last one, yeah, I remember is Sleeping Dogs. You know, it was kind of like a John Woo type of open world game. It's obviously, you know, the Asians are having a better time than you guys, but like, The Ghost of Tsushima was made by Sucker Punch, I think.
That's right.
And that got some backlash for whatever reason. I mean, what are your thoughts about that? I think like they did a pretty damn good. It's a weird, iffy type of thing. It's like, it's a Western developer making a samurai game.
Yeah.
And it's a damn good samurai game. And some Japanese developers actually gave them credits. Like, they made a better samurai game than some of our developers.
Yeah.
So when you see like things like that, maybe they had great consultants and everything. Like, it is kind of like a line there where I think right, it's okay. Absolutely. But some people, I can see why people can be offended by that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I often think of it like a balance. You know, we're constantly, you know, we're constantly consuming media that is going to inspire us. And, yeah, and it's always coming from different cultures, from different settings, whether, you know, based in reality or fantasy, et cetera. And then, you know, when that media hits us, we immediately want to, or not immediately, but some of us want to take part in that, to be able to contribute to it in some kind of way, to say, I love this so much. You know, this is just my letter to that. I understand that. And, you know, but I also think that there's a balance or a way to do that that feels meaningful, a way that doesn't feel like it's taking away from the content that you care deeply about, and where that territory starts to look gray or not have really one answer for, I think comes or starts to become a little bit more indicative by the amount of work or research that went into a certain game. A game like Ghost of Tsushima, like Sucker Punch put the work in.
Yeah.
There's no denying like this admiration for Akira Kurosawa films and the extent that went into that, as well as just the gameplay and the story that's placed in there. It has really great narrative gameplay. You know, it is absolutely a great game. Mm-hmm. When we are, you know, there's certainly nuance to be able to critique certain historical accuracies or, you know, misrepresentations. And I think those types of things happen when, or let me back up and say, those types of risks are increased when you are a studio that is not of that culture. Mm-hmm. And yes, they did consult with Japanese developers I don't know what extent as far as like history, but I know its story does have, you know, some sort of historical significance. And I don't think, you know, a game like Ghost of Tsushima, if that were in anybody's hands, Japanese, the background of developers that is at Sucker Punch or Space, that we are always going to land the mark 100% perfectly.
Yeah.
You know, Japanese creators also brought or Team Ninja specifically created Neo, and you know, the representations of William and other characters like Yasuke and you know, just the Dutch story that is presented with its initial telling of that is, you know, I mean obviously that game's like very high fantasy, and so the story of that is stretched to its benefit. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think any studio is going to not hit the mark 100% accurately, you know, unless you are endeavoring to make a historically accurate game.
Yeah. Like, I mean, just look at all the Final Fantasy movies. I mean, games. Yeah. You know, my friend Larry always had the problem with the black character in that one.
Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah. What's his name again? I forgot.
Barrett.
Yeah. Barrett is kind of like the one in Naruto, right? It's just like this. They definitely have a prototype for when using black characters in anime. And
yeah.
It's gotten better, but like it's still kind of like the same issue.
And you think of Barrett and, you know, the influence of American media in Japan. Yeah. And obviously
that's where they're getting it from, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That was the A team. Somebody saw Mr. Yeah. T. And yeah.
I was like, that's, you know, that's
clear. How it is. But, so it goes both ways. It goes everywhere.
Mm-hmm. So with Onsen, with 5-year development, right? So with your ups and downs, and I'm guessing you had to learn a lot of roles on the job, right?
That's right.
Your background was in 3D, and mm-hmm. Were you handling, or was your partner handling the game design? Like, what was the split work here? What were you mostly kind of hands-on on?
Yeah, originally it was just the three of us, and so it was me, you know, the friend that I spoke of, Tim, and then eventually bringing on a programmer, Leo. And so the three of us put together, you know, the first main stage that is the game and the game mechanics that were most important to it. My role consisted of everything that wasn't programming. And so that was the character design, the 3D modeling, animation, game design. Tim was game design and producing. And so we balanced the many hats as best as we could, but yeah, that's kind of the division of labor. It was then after, you know, I mentioned Whitethorn, you know, partnering with us for the remaining of the development. And that's where, you know, I got to take some of those hats, like animation and be able to bring on another team member for that. The same goes for some of the roles like UI, UX and so on.
You know, the appetite for these type of games, I feel, have been increasing. People are just want to have a good time. I think if anything, if you look at the Summer Festival of Games, where we kind of get the preview, you know, what the next year or two are, it feels like mm-hmm. it is returning to more simpler type of games, right? Mm-hmm. For a long time, I think a good stretch before the pandemic, and especially during the pandemic, there was a lot of live service type of games, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What I saw was a lot of single player games, a lot of remakes, but a lot of single player games, singular campaign games. People just want to follow a story, want to just do this thing without, you know, getting too involved. Are you kind of seeing this pattern? I know that you made this game right before all this stuff was happening. Making a game truly to what you want to make and play. But were you able to kind of pick up on a lot of these things as the years went by? Did you change the original design based on kind of like where you saw the trends were, or did you add anything to it? Just reflecting off of what what everybody was doing.
You know, the only thing that was added to the game that kind of reflected maybe the media of the time, came a little bit from Souls-like series from Software's Dark Souls and Sekiro and all these other titles. The way that is represented is it really just a small thing. So we have bosses in the game that will happen within the third set or the third part of each stage that you visit. To borrow a little bit of inspiration, we just did a health bar that is very similar looking to to a Dark Souls game. And by similar, I just mean it is at the center. It is very low and thin, and we have the boss's name, you know, right above the health bar. But it is embedded into the story. I think in some of the later changes that happen within the art direction in the game, it's probably more represented in some of that stuff that you'll see. But that was honestly the only thing. I think when it comes to being an indie developer, you know, they as a space, there's always that sort of ability to be as a part of the movement or not as avant-garde as you want to, and have that luxury because there's going to be an audience that is interested in that sort of change up. And so with Onsen Master, you know, we didn't do much else that represented, you know, any other movements. It was like, we like Overcooked, we like Diner Dash. So yeah.
You love Nintendo. It definitely has the Nintendo art style down. Yeah. Those two games in particular, I feel like I noticed those games until like basically the Wii was coming out, right? Mm-hmm. Where, you know, there was so much interaction going on with the unique control scheme that they got with the Wii,
yeah,
motion controls. And they were addicting as hell. I mean, aside from those inspiration, were there other inspiration that you guys, you in particular, was aspiring to?
Yeah, and that was to keep gameplay kind of easy to learn, moderately complex to master. I really valued you, and I'm glad you brought up Nintendo, because I really value a lot of the games, you know, like from Mario to, I don't know, Splatoon or something like that. All of them carry an aesthetic that's very family friendly, and then mechanics that are generally approachable. But if you really, really want to get good at the game, you know, it takes a little bit more time or a concerted effort to understand them. That was kind of certainly an inspiration that we carried into Onsen, and think of those games like Mario and so on as, you know, very high achieving examples of how you can deliver gameplay to somebody. Mm-hmm.
Like talking about landscape and changes, you know, there's like three camps, right? Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo. Like, yeah. Sony and Microsoft is buying everybody, right?
Yeah.
And we were talking about preserving history as much as we can. Like, I'm still afraid that Nintendo's going to be bought out by one of those guys. And, you know, at first they're going to say there's no change, but, you know, with everything, there's always change. Right. And Nintendo is very unique in their way that they're not really a competitor to those other two. They're kind of marching to their own tune. And I think with people like us who kind of grew up in the 80s, still have a lot of affinity with Nintendo. Mm. I mean, I do see like younger generation liking the Switch, because they're killing it with the Switch.
Yeah.
But these type of games in particular, I do feel that our generation plays it more than, let's say, my 10-year-old. And that's just a general, well, my very specific observation, right? How are you feeling with like those type of gameplay experiences when it turns to like age group, right? Are you seeing like a shift here? You know, you said you have the one kid's too young. How old is your older one? Your stepson's 14.
He just turned 14. So and I've been with him since he was six. So I to what you're talking about, I've seen, you know, that sort of shift of gameplay experiences, that shift of exposure, you know, kind of in that prime age of when they're, you know, really starting to take in games and understand them and develop an interest to, you know, now, you know, being a teenager and having very specific, you know, interests within certain genre. Mm-hmm. To answer your question, you know, one of the things that stood out to me were games like Minecraft and Roblox,
yeah,
and later Fortnite became really highly valued around himself and his friends. And this is it was primarily because of the user generated content, mm-hmm, that was available in these games, but then also it was absolutely impacted and sort of thrusted into the focus because of the pandemic as well, because mm-hmm, a lot of those games became environments that could become secondary for social gatherings and doing things specific with your friends. When I ask him, and you know, I'll poke his friend's brain all the time about the type of games that they care about. And they are the most popular, I would say the more popular commercial games that, that you would expect a young boy to play. And it's honestly very stereotyped, you know, even though I try to suggest, you know, like, hey, what about this, like, you know, cool single player game. And, you know, he'll say that something and said like, I'll watch you play, but I don't think I want to play it. So I'll ask like, okay, well, you know, like what are the games that you care about and why? And so he likes Fortnite. He likes Rainbow Six Siege. He likes, Forza Motorsport. He likes, you know, all these other titles, and the why being, you know, because I get to play with my friends and, because, you know, they're, you know, building these fun experiences within Fortnite, or we'll try these goofy things that are specific to, any of those games. I think the social relationship, in games is probably the most prevalent thing that I notice in, growing generations where, say for you and me, we grew up with single player games and the connectivity didn't come around until like PlayStation 2.
You gotta pay for it. It's like, I had
Final Fantasy Zero 11 for free. And SOCOM.
It's like, I got to buy this thing.
Yeah. The network adapter and
it was complicated.
You know, it was lugging Xboxes and TVs to play Halo and all of that stuff. But I think where games are going, or I would say where games are at least thriving currently, still hovers around that social experience. And I think for generations that are upcoming, like your kid and mine, you know, that will still be a valued part of the relationship in the games, or a valued part in the relationship that they develop with games is, you know, can I do this with my friends? Can I make my own stuff? Can I customize my character? That type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously has a place. It's cool, right? To see how online social interaction is so easy now for basically every game that they want to play. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like probably you, I grew up with Onimusha. I grew up with Spyro the Dragon. I grew up with Crash. I played everything single player. Metal Gear Solid, Final Fantasies, all of them. There's like I don't know. It wires your brain differently than these first person shooters. Even with Roblox, if you're crafting something cool, it's kind of better. But like, you know, being able to walk through a story and kind of be fed the same type of emotions, your main character is being fed, how you're supposed to be feeling at this moment as we're kind of unraveling this narrative. Like that's a huge part of, I think, of, at least creatively made us who we are, right? How we want to construct an experience. And, you know, my kid's 11. He doesn't respect what I do, but he plays it all the time, right? He's like, whatever, right? But if he wants to be a game developer, at least creatively, I don't think his brain is wired, maybe for better or for worse, the same way to be able to craft an experience in that way. And maybe that's why I'm surprised to see so much single player being announced over Summerfest, so many remakes, because I like preserving that part of the game industry, I feel is pretty important, right? I don't want to wait till Netflix figure out this interactive thing that they're trying to do, right? Where you're just, it's not the same, dude. It's not like, like clicking next, you know, scenario. That's not the same. But just based on how everything's going, not even just the storytelling, like games like yours, I think it's so important, you know, because I grew up with strategy games too, like not XCOM, but I played Command and Conquered a lot.
Yep.
RTS, those type of games. And that is another type of experience. It's like chess, basically, right?
Yeah.
And No kids like that right now. It's like,
it's true.
I whipped out my PlayStation 1 because I kept all like, they're in suitcases, right? But these are all the games that made me who I am. And I showed it to them, and I even got like a legacy PlayStation 1 so that you can actually play it. No interest. I was like, hey, you should play this. game. This game, like, was a big part of my teenage years. It's like, oh, whatever. It's like Final Fantasy.
Yeah.
It's the best story ever. Yeah.
We want so badly to impart the experiences because single player experiences for us, the shared experience was being able to, you know, tell the impact that the story had on you with, mm-hmm. with another friend, Final Fantasy IX, and then bumping into another, you know, kid who also, you know, had that boss battle experience. And so I tried the same thing. You know, one of my favorite games is Tenchu on PlayStation 2.
I love Tenchu. Yep.
God, the game's incredible.
Yeah.
And I was wanting so badly to relay that sense of its gameplay to my stepkid, and it didn't resonate. You know, it was the same thing. It was, I'll watch you play that, but you know, I don't care. You know, you asked a question that was like, you know, I wonder if, you know, the types of games or maybe these single player games are at all at risk by the type of media or gameplay experiences that younger audiences are preferential to. And I think the answer to that is no. I think both of those that we're always going to have new kind of genre defining games, gameplay experiences and spaces. But I think it just adds to the breadth of games and game experiences that people enjoy consuming, because you know, we still see the emergence of new RTS games and then the community of individuals that enjoy them. And I think, you know, in some kind of way, there's always going to be a group who does, you know, passionately care about those genres, you know, and there's always going to be groups who, you know, care more about battle royales. Mm-hmm. I think what makes it maybe feel like, you know, you know, will this at all be, you know, kind of the end of a single player experience? It's just the genres for like these types of user generated content, these conversations that hover around creating metaverse experiences within like Fortnite and things like that. It's just so salient. It's so salient and burgeoning that we hear about it everywhere, and we see other companies that have the resources to dive in and explore that very, very high right now. I think if we go back to, you know, like before PUBG and all that stuff, like right now it's like what, BRs, souls like,
yeah,
and you know, those are the genres that we think about. Yeah. But it was very different. It was very different 10 years ago, and it was very different before, you know, battle royale games. I think another one that was MOBAs. MOBAs were yeah. really salient, you know, yeah. around when I was in university. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think, you know, again, kind of circling back, I think it's going to present new stuff. I think there are a lot of studios that have the resources to be able to explore and then pour so much marketing into it that we see it all the time. And it creates, you know, like a perceived value around this is the game that everybody wants to play. But I think generations like your 10-year-old and my 14-year-old are going to, they're going to take those experiences and they're going to redefine what type of games they want to play. Yeah. And they'll be the, you know, the next developers, and we'll see something totally different. It might just be like, yeah, I was just about to say PlayStation Home just comes back and, you know, we're like, what are you doing? And like, I don't know. I'm just hanging out in my digital living room with my friends, and we are watching Netflix. And that's it. You know, that might be what they care about. Yeah,
it's true. I mean, I'm just waiting. There probably is a meme video out there comparing PlayStation Home to, I guess, Horizon, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, Sony, like, probably hurt, you know, crying over the fact that it looks worse. It's like Meta, like, they're trying to be Nintendo, but not really. You know what I mean? Like, they're kind of stylized, which is a smart decision, but it's like, this is made by corporate overlords, man. This type of game, it's the, like, whenever I tease this a lot, we have these roundtable, and with when I talk to Ray, it just looks like, you know, when you're watching a movie and suddenly a game is popping up in the background, the kid's playing it, and it's made by like non-developers, right? It just looks obviously bad.
Yeah.
And it just looks like that for Horizon. It's just people around the table chatting it up. It's like nobody wants to do this. It's not fun. It's the weirdest thing. It's a game console, but you're trying your best not to promote games, right? And so, you know, I love the idea of Metaverse. I like probably you and many game developers or gamers look at Ready Player One, and we don't look at the Dysotopia or like Doomsday. We look like, oh, that's a cool game. I would love to be like, that's the message I got from that. I was like, I would love to be a part of this. So I think that's part of our future still, but we are in a, I do feel like we're in a stumbling block because, you know, it's going to take a while to get there. And probably you're right. It will probably take this next generation to figure that out, because I feel like our generation isn't figuring that part out. We didn't grow up around where it's YouTube and social games, where we're able to kind of reimagine it to make a metaverse work, because the efforts that I'm seeing right now, I feel like it's taking a step back. It's like, guys, it's an RPG, right? That's what the metaverse is. We did WoW like 20 years ago. Like, why is this why is this worse than WoW?
Yeah, we have WoW. We had Second Life. We had,
what's going on?
These conversations have been here. Yeah.
So I do look at that, and I am worried. Like, what's going on? And it's just like we're aging out, I guess. Or something. Our developers are aging out, just not doing it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, you know, if there's like a piece of advice that I would give to somebody is listen to the kids. They're going to indicate, you know, what the next market of entertainment will be, because they are taking in the things that, you know, have been created by us. And just like every other, you know, cycle of art movements to historical movements, they always end up being, you know, kind of an antithesis to its predecessor, something that took that experience and said, well, now I want to become this out of it, and it becomes the answer to it. And that's how we, you know, kind of iterate forward on art, on technology, on a lot of things. And so, yeah, no, it's not up to people older than me to decide what the metaverse is going to be. They're going to keep trying these things, and they're going to throw these darts at the dartboard. And the one that lands is the one that the kids go, give me that one. And actually, I'll just work on it.
Yeah, exactly. Just move over, old man.
Yeah. So we'll see it happen, and it'll come, and it'll hit us the way that, the way that Fortnite hit the gamers that, are younger than me. It was, we didn't know that was going to be what everybody wanted to play.
Yeah.
Epic didn't know that, you know?
Well, I mean, they saw it in PUBG. They knew something.
Yeah. Right. So I'm not saying that they're just operating with zero market research, but, you know, it was to see it represented the way that it is now.
Yeah.
You know, and
definitely, and that, yeah, stepped up. Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I will say that. Yeah. It's going to be the darkest mark in history. Like, nobody's talking about it, but I'll say it over and over again. I mean, that story, how they kind of ripped off PUBG blatantly.
Yep. Yeah.
Is the best bet they've made. You know, risk assessment that they ever had for, like, oh, they might sue us, but it's okay. We'll make multiple billions of dollars. And I was like, oh, okay.
Right. And then they took social media. We had this movement of like, okay, so we ripped off social media. Like, they're in the room and they said, what else do the kids like? And they're like, give them the Instagram or give them the TikTok dance moves.
Yeah.
So we saw the emotes, you know, or not emotes, but we saw the dance moves, show up in Fortnite, and people,
and
like,
all these dancers are mad. It's like, I think it feel like finally they cooled off. It's like, all right, maybe we shouldn't just keep copying what's hot right now, because people are catching on that we're like Facebook. We're buying things, or just taking things from the smaller developers now.
Yep.
But all right, man. Well, I mean, we're actually at the hour mark. I'm super happy to talk to you, man. It was great kind of hearing your experience. Onsen Master, tell the good people out there. This is the part where I shut up. Tell the good people out there how to find it, how to get it right now.
Yeah. So On Semester is coming to PC and console. You can wishlist it on Steam right now. And if you want to follow more about the game and things to follow, I would recommend going to Waking Oni Games. That's the at handle for Twitter.
All right. Perfect, dude, man. It's you're a pro. It was a pleasure to have you on. Maybe one day we'll go onsen together. Maybe that's too forward. I don't know how they do it.
No, there. Please, let's. Yes. Ikimashou. Right. That would be great.
All right, there we go. All right, let's put that date on the board. As always, guys, it was great. Thank you for everyone that is listening. As always, all the information will be in the description links below. And have a good one.